Welcome everyone to the first in however episode, how many episodes of Doctor Who's coming up. There is episodes, I don't know. Do you know, Magnus?
How I don't many episodes? Know. Was I supposed know. To?
No, I guess I'm supposed
I'll
to.
Look it up.
Have a look it up. Look up. I'm going to guess 8. My brain says 8, but I think I'm wrong. I think it's 10. I don't know. Oh, I don't care. Chop, chop, Magnus. You're meant to be a researcher. Come on.
Well, I'm just getting a lot of pop-ups and such. Blah, 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 blah. It doesn't actually tell me. Doctor Who. Doctor Who Season 2 episode titles.
Oh, I know how to do this. If I put into Google how many episodes of Doctor Who
Hold on.
What?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, you're doing it old school.
8.
That is sad.
There's 8.
I said 8 to start with.
Did you?
I think I did. I did. Well, I didn't. You went and started and I said, I think it's 8. Rewind the tape, did you say?
Yeah.
You're playing the tape. I don't know.
Rewind you see it so I can check.
Oh, rewind the tape. I mean, that's interesting because I got confused then because as we're talking, we've got a transcript being generated and it was giving me the wrong information on the transcript, what you were saying. So once again, AI being very confusing.
ADHD brain also tricking you. I recommend that you turn off the fake subtitles now because it's just going to happen again.
Yeah, it will. It will. Will it cure the ADHD though, Magnus?
Anything
won't let
is
me.
Possible.
It won't let me. It won't let me. I'm just going to have to go old school and drape, I don't know, a sock or something over the side of my screen. That could be a way to make it work. I mean, this is a very painful segue following that very previous painfully ill-researched bit to start the show. That this episode we're about to talk about is very much all about AI to some degree, isn't it? There is a little bit of a commentary playing out in this one. I mean, before we start, you're doing all right, Magnus? We haven't spoken since the end of last season. Did we do one after the last season? We didn't do the Christmas one. We were going to, but things got...
I was absent.
Screaming into the void. It's a busy thing to do.
Yes. Screaming into the void.
So this is... We haven't talked about Doctor Who at all since round about then.
Not really.
So just to ask, first of all, did you... Brain is going already... Were you waiting for this? Were you aware of this? Or was it just me contacting you through the screaming void and sort of saying, hey, would you be interested in doing a podcast on that?
No, I was aware that it was coming out.
Well, that's good, because I think before we go into the actual episode, we could just quickly talk about some of the rumours, which I don't believe that you're aware of. Because you don't follow the podcast, which is fine.
It's true, I don't.
Neither do I. I have no idea what goes on outside of my bits. There's been some conversation for a while that Shuti Gat was leaving. That's been pretty much floating in the ether.
Got here.
And then more recently, there was conversations that Disney was not picking up for a season 3. Or series 3, which again, we don't know how accurate that rumor is. And then more recently, Russell T. Davis in an interview on the BBC kind of sort of says, like, Doctor Who's like Robin Hood, in the sense it's mythical. If it stops, it'll eventually come back. For the kids watching now, they will have it when they get older, like I did when I and. There's a sort of very much of a sense of a prepping towards an announcement that this could be the final chapter for the time being. Now, what I think is interesting in this and what I kind of want your opinion on, because I've already given my opinion to the people listening to this already, is this a problem with the current incarnation, or if there is a reason for Disney to sort of think this isn't making the numbers, is it something to do with Doctor Who as a whole?
But Disney doesn't own it now, right? It's still being produced by the BBC, or it's not?
Yes, BBC own it. The Disney supply money towards it and distribute it. But they are allegedly quite hands-off on it. But I think the idea is, as if Disney pulls out, the cost of it in its current form would be something the BBC wouldn't take forward.
It survived just on the BBC alone.
Well, this is it. And I think some of the problems... Yeah.
Well, I just mean for, like, as you say, generations.
But we're living in a different era now, I guess, and the BBC is changing and its output's changing, and the way it delivers its output will soon change as well. Eventually, you know, the next few years, broadcasts will dry up and stop, and everything will be on demand or certainly online. You know, where does Doctor Who, a show made for families to watch around the fire on Saturday nights, when there was initially three channels, can that exist in this content-driven?
Well, I think that's very much not a problem with the current incarnation, but just a problem with media and the current climate generally. Like, all of those things affect broadcasting and media companies, right? So everything is kind of up in the air and in flux. I don't think it's about the specific program.
No. Well, that's pretty much exactly what I said last week.
I mean, way back when, Doctor Who presumably was on once a week, and there were many episodes. So even what you're being offered now is in seasons, and it's 8 or 9 episodes. So it's very short comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you release them all at once, you could, I guess, binge watch them, like with a lot of other shows. But I think it just sort of speaks to the changing media environment, or just where companies are trying to predict and respond to what viewers are going to want.
Mm. Yeah. This is where I think it is as well, that it's not a judgment on the quality or the character of its current incarnation.
I just don't really get the sense that that would be the main issue, when the main issue is clearly our whole global media industry is having to respond to now AI, as in never before in human history have we had to respond to AI, you know, being used to write a TV show or write a novel, or generate art based on stolen art of other people. You know, these are all very new, they're very novel problems, or repackaged old problems, and people are just having to respond to that. And I guess if you're, a media conglomerate, it's we're not going to say that we're going to renew it for a third season because we don't know what's going to happen in the next 6 months. I do think that Doctor Who is mythical in a way, kind of was. I can see what he's saying about that. It is the kind of show that can just reemerge, because when they brought it back for Eccleston, that was a big, big, big hiatus gap. But I think, having time between incarnations or longer time between seasons isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Look at Gladiators. I mean, Gladiators took a time away and it's back exactly the same.
It is pretty much exactly the same.
The Travelator, whatever they call it, exactly the same materials. just the same.
It's so strange. What a bonkers show to like. I viscerally remember watching it as a child with my family. Like when I see it now, it's like, you know, the lettering, the branding, I'm like, oh, it's like being a child again. Also, as a child, I didn't really understand the concept of a heel character in wrestling. So, you know, there was was it Wolf maybe or something?
Yes, Wolf.
And he was like the bad guy. And as a child, you're just like, this is the bad guy. He's evil.
I find it weird because it's very performative, the Gladiators. Yeah, I know you people came to listen to Doctor Who. I don't care. Gladiators was very performative, or still is, as is wrestling, as you say, as a comparison. And yet, and again, people who know Gladiators might be able to tell me differently. But wrestling, while it's performative, there are actual moves being made there which can damage the human body. While with Gladiators, everything looks very padded, with very carefully padded health and safety inspected spaces, all risk assessed for television.
We want them to be safe, James.
But at the same time, they play it as if it's kind of, you know, that they are sort of scary, raw, like Wolf, you know, I'll come and get you, but I'm heavily padded while I am. And yet wrestling, yes, it's performative, but yeah, that stuff it's not good for your back. You know, there's stuff there which is like, yeah, you are legitimately tough people to be doing this because you're going to damage your bodies within the next 20 years.
I don't really know anything about wrestling. You know what? You should talk to Tom Phillips.
Oh, yes.
That was his specialism.
Yeah, Tom. Yes, that would be, if it was a podcast about that, which it ain't.
Could be, though.
But it's incarnations now. I mean, the first incarnation I saw of Gladiators was American Gladiators in the 90s when I was quite drunk at 4 a.m. in the morning around people's houses and it'd be on television. And the sight of people running at doors, not knowing whether there's a gladiator behind or not. Do you remember that game where there would sort of be a gladiator behind a sort of panel and they'd rush at it and sometimes they'd just break through it and other times they'd bounce off because there'd be a gladiator behind it with a, and that was as a slightly inebriated teenager, hilarious.
That's, a Jackass.
It was, yeah. Well, it was that era, wasn't it? It was just before Jackass became its big thing. But anyway, I suppose people want to talk about this show. Doctor Who, Episode 1, The Robot Revolution, I believe it was called. Yep. Mm. Written by Russell T. Davis. What were your feelings when you watched this? I'm just going to throw you in there.
My initial feelings are, I can't believe that James is making me fucking sit down to watch a specific thing. Doesn't he know that I like to spend my days without doing anything at all? So rude of him. Grumble.
It's the abusive relationship, the abuser and the abused. I was made to do this, so I have to find someone to share my pain and pass on the misery.
Then I started watching it and I was like, wow, that's an amazing kilt. And then I was in.
Yeah.
That's all
it took. Incredible outfit.
It was great.
I was disappointed that for most of the episode, the kilt was no longer there, that the outfit disappeared and he was in this sort of very...
But it did the work. It did the work that it needed to do.
It pulled you in. I mean, it's still... It feels, this incarnation of the show feels, I can't think of what, if it still feels, I don't want to say very queer, but just like that rocket that takes off at the beginning, that he gets in, it's a big yellow, really ornate, crazy sort of 50s-like rocket. There's a real sense of breaking those sort of very... those expectations of what you'd see in a sci-fi show like Doctor Who at the moment, where you imagine it to be sort of kind of a greasy ship or a ship. This is like real out there, old style camp.
That ray guns.
Yes, the ray guns.
Yeah, incinerate people.
Yes, that was an interesting effect. I wasn't sure at first, and I was like, okay.
Yeah. No, it was really interesting. I liked it. I thought it was a good way of sort of reintroducing the audience after the hiatus between seasons.
Yes. What did you think of this, dare we say, companion/assistant, however we call this role? Belinda.
I really liked her. Belinda, yeah. She wasn't what I was expecting, but she is kind of giving Martha vibes a little bit. Because they're both medics, aren't they? Well, Martha was a
doctor.
An MD.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah. And I assumed that she was a doctor too, as well, at first. And then she clarifies later. Yeah, I really liked her. I thought she was fun. I mean, the first scene where she's with, is it Al?
Mm.
The boy, the
Alan,
young boyfriend. It's quite cringy.
Mm.
And I kind of liked that because, you know, they're both quite young. He's being so incredibly earnest and also so, so patronizing. And it's just very familiar. And it's interesting that the way that the story is set is like he basically buys this star for her, names it after her, and that is what causes all the problems.
Mm. Yeah, it's a nice joke which plays well in that prologue where you get where you have the robot forcing the certificate into her face and saying, you know, you are our queen, and so you've got to be kidding. It's got that sense of the audience feeling exactly the same thing at that point, because they're by that point they're probably guessing where this is all going. I mean, I think later on there's a sort of notion of, or a commentary on incel culture that she
there
makes.
Is, yeah, which I think is really interesting given that Adolescence, the Netflix limited series, has become so I guess widely talked about in a lot of different circles. So I think it's obviously commenting on quite like a present problem, or something that's like definitely creeping into the mainstream awareness a lot more.
Yeah, it was a little more adjacent to my understanding of incel, what it was talking about, but it was definitely talking about certain sort of masculine approaches or male approaches to relationships.
Yeah, I mean, what is actually being depicted is, you know, a man who is seeking to control, like, his, like, female partner. And she does say coercive control at some point. Mm. Coercive control is sort of that, where you can basically coerce or persuade or manipulate. Like, you use all these tools where, like, that isn't necessarily the overt threat of violence, but it isn't not there either. And like forcing all of these things in order to like have ultimate control over someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is interesting because he does sort of say right at the beginning, like he calls it Miss Belinda. Mm. And she's like, does it have to be Miss? And he's like, well, are you married? No, then it's Miss. As if, like, the important thing is, like, her marital status. Like, you either belong to a man or you don't. Rather than just being herself as a whole person.
Yeah, it felt a bit like a comment on almost internet behavior, and obviously it's not these sort of things happen, but those sort of comments about, you know, if you're a miss or not feel very like you'd see in a comments section below a post of some sort, and him also being pictured as someone who plays video games late at night as well.
Yeah,
it was like some weird little jigsaw pieces of that sort of speak to certain types of toxic or behavior associated with certain male types, which so it wasn't quite as explicit as adolescence, as you say, or but it was there was something there which was toying with some of those.
Yeah, I think it's speaking attitudes. To sort of themes that get talked about in mainstream culture or problems that are recognized. I think, especially because the AI generator is just him, and he's actually orchestrated this whole situation in order to force compliance, which I thought was really interesting.
It reminds me a little, just you talking about it there, of the whole labyrinth, the David Bowie and Sarah Connolly, you know, where he has all this power, he has this entire construct made to control and to take something in a way that he wants it to go, and then at the end he's there sort of pleading for her to worship him so he can he'll be her slave, you know. There's this sort of interesting, again, those sort of power dynamics of trying to get what you want, which are at play here, which reminded me a little bit of Bowie.
Yeah.
Love me, worship me, and I'll be your slave.
Yeah, I think it's also I think it's something like, I ask for so little, just let me rule you, fear me, love me, do as I say, and I will be your slave.
Yes, I ask for so little.
But first, let me rule you.
Yes.
And then fear me, then love me, then do as I say.
That is Labyrinth, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's very powerful, that very powerful scene sort of goes unnoticed quite often. So so we have this whole situation where it feels vaguely familiar, to be honest. I think the new series does this quite a lot, where they'll have the Doctor doing very little in the first act, sort of running around after something which either we're not sure of or we know what he's running after but doesn't quite get there in time. And then he disappears for a bit, and we have her coming to this planet. The planet looks very nice. It looks very lavish, and you can see where all this money is kind of going. There's always a bit of me which feels like, I remember back in the 90s when there was this hiatus, as you say, and watching The X-Files and going, couldn't they just do Doctor Who like this? Does it have to have lots of money behind it? Couldn't it just be sort of not show and tell, just all suggestive and earth-based? But I suppose in a way, we're in a culture now where what survives is what's memorable. And I suppose you put loads of money behind something, make it look great so it stands out against so many different shows.
It's got to be shiny.
Yeah. And it's trying to look shiny in a way steps out from most of the others. I mean, the nearest things I could say to having sort of a Doctor Who style I can think of are things like, I don't know, Guardians of the Galaxy or Thor Ragnarok. Yeah. Other than that, it doesn't quite really, like,
almost overly saturated kind of color palette type.
Very comic-y, a bit like the rocket ship, and as you said, the robots and their guns is sort of very a comic style. And it feels to me as if it's a show which has recognized that it's no longer in a market where it can just be broad, like a broadcast television, and just appeal to everyone. It's gone. We want to look a certain way, and we want it to be styled a certain way. And I get the feeling it's styled for sort of young adults, maybe older kids, aimed at sort of trying to tap into that sort of audience, because all the other audiences are kind of tapped out. You know, all the Star Wars, Disney stuff, all the sort of traditional Doctor Who audiences you'd think of being 30s and 40s, 50s. They've already got so many shows. I can kind of see where they've gone. We're going to roll the dice and aim this at perhaps something which feels a little younger and aimed at perhaps a slightly different mindset.
I definitely think so, because, I mean, not only do you have Ben Shooty, but you also have, like, his wardrobe and the way that he's stylized. So it's definitely speaking to, a younger audience. But not necessarily children, because they haven't, like, made it a children's show. Like, it's still the same sort of concepts. But, I agree.
Well, it's one of those quick interruptions from me once again, in which I remind you about the benefits of joining our free Patreon. I mean, it's free, so that's a benefit in itself. It's also ad-free, so you don't get any of the Apple Podcasts or Spotify ads whilst listening. dare I say it, we give you extra content. And incredibly, we also release it early. So, for example, this chat between James and Magnus that you're listening to at the moment, this was actually published on our Patreon on Sunday, around 24 hours after the episode aired on TV or streamed on Disney Plus or however you watched it. So you can get our in-depth analysis. And this is a great podcast that we're listening to, by the way, isn't it? You can get more of this early by joining our Patreon, which is free. So please head over to patreon.com/Casterbras and sign up. Thanks.
I mean, obviously, in the last couple of series where Russell T. Davis has had it, you know, with the Tainted Tenant stuff, we had sort of conversations around pronouns. We've got a very strong actor, person of colour who, let's face it, is a very queer doctor. These are sort of spaces which I'm not saying people in 30s, 40s and 50s won't embrace, but it feels like there's a market there, a younger market, where it feels would more potentially naturally embrace it, maybe.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Yes.
It's like, yeah. I think if the risk is alienating a particular type of audience, then you would naturally double down in order to, you know, buy into the other available audiences, right?
It feels like it's made a decision and it's going down that route. And I suppose that's where Doctor Who was back in 2005. It was, there was a lot more sexual references, gay references. It was, the cast was multiracial to some degree. So it was always, even back in the 2000s, trying to push its boundaries a bit. But I suppose it's been a long time since it's had 20 years now of fans, literally 20 years, you know, a couple of generations, a couple of new generations of fans. You know, where do you take it now? And I suppose, yes, it feels to me like a show aimed at a sort of younger audience that's trying to be bright and vivid and exciting in a way that makes it distinct. But is that enough in a market which is just so bloody busy, so many things to watch? I mean, we've said this before. I mean, how many things have we said we'd watch and got frustrated because we've not got to the end of them because there's always something else?
No things, James. So I don't watch no things.
I know. Rings of power, Magnus. Rings of power.
Shh.
Vikings. Remember when we were going to finish Vikings? Black Sails. Why is that not on any of the streams?
I'm pretty sure I've got it on DVD, Black Sails.
What, even the last season?
You got the last season? I can't remember.
I know you had the first season because I saw season on DVD.
The thing with Black Sails was that the ending got spoilt for me before I even started watching the show.
But it hasn't been spoilt for me, so.
Okay, well, I'm just saying that's where the reluctance came from. So I knew how it was going to end.
Oh, damn it, yeah. Yes, yeah, so there is just so much, and there is so much still to come. I was looking on one of the websites, and it was just showing all the stuff coming out, you know, this year, and there's just still, it's just constantly so much stuff. Last of Us is coming out this next week. I've still got to finish. I've started rewatching it, and I need to finish the first season. Last of Us, Walking Dead, Dead City, season 2's out next month as well.
Listen, there's way too much Walking Dead.
Oh god, yes,
way too much of it. I don't understand how you've managed to consume it all, because it's too much.
I just, people who aren't aware, I introduced some family to it, I think last July or August, and we managed to watch all of Walking Dead, all of Fall of the Walking Dead, all the spin-off seasons bar Walking Dead Beyond.
How many seasons is that?
I don't make me count. This must be over 20 something odd. It's it's a crazy run. Anyway, so this is one of the reasons I think Doctor Who struggles. It just does. And I think now it's made the risk it had to always take of trying to go global by making this deal with Disney so it could reach out. You're now no longer under the protective umbrella of the BBC. You've got commercial entities, which, as you said, will turn around and go, is this actually working for us? If it's not, we're just going to walk away from it because it's no skin off our nose. It's not our national institution. You know, we don't care. And I think that's a problem. And I just don't see any doctor, even David Tennant, to be honest, really changing that situation if it was to, you know, if it had stayed with the new David Tennant and then moved to Disney. I'm just not sure that would have guaranteed it any more than where it is now.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is that there isn't any guarantee in any of it. Like, it could all just collapse in on itself. And ultimately, like, I think that Doctor Who, especially for, you know, British audiences, is something that is always resurrectable. And it has staying power, and it has this long, you know, mythos and history within television that I think that I don't think that it'll be particularly harmed if, like, it stops running for however long, because I think it can always be resurrected.
Yeah, absolutely. And with streaming, 2013 streaming coming in, up until that point, it was largely uncontested that it just had its spot, and it had very little to actually fight against. And since then, we've seen the numbers on Doctor Who on terrestrial dropping, largely in relation to everything else on terrestrial dropping. As I say, you know, EastEnders will now get 6.5 million, when, you know, back in the day, at the time when apparently we were both kids some point in the past, you know, it would have been getting 18 to 19 million. You know, everything has reduced and withered. It's a difficult situation for it.
Viewers are fundamentally different now, and we are interacting with our media in fundamentally different ways. So, yeah, things are having to adapt.
But I mean, if we go to Star Wars, Andor, I'm sure was originally said to be several seasons. I'm sure someone said 5, and it's now been confirmed, I think the second is its last one. You know, the Obi-Wan Kenobi was meant to be a film, and then that got moved to being a 6-part TV show. Everything feels, as you say, in flux, and everything feels uncertain, even those sort of big names. So for a show to have existed, you know, 60 years, let's say 20 on television since 2005, largely because it has owned that space, a big fish in a very small pond, throw it into the bigger pond where it's meant to fight and, you know, I don't know where the analogy goes now, but it's meant to do whatever it was doing. What I don't know what big fishes do in small ponds. Do they have any benefits there? It's always said as, I can't imagine what a big fish in a small pond says, and actually, apart from it being big. But if you take that,
it just means that it's the top fish and no other fish are trying to eat it. And when you take the big fish out of a small pond and you put it in a bigger pond or a lake or the sea, it suddenly realizes there's so many other things that are bigger than me that are going to eat me and think that I'm a tiny, tasty morsel.
But I suppose from the BBC's perspective, I don't mean the BBC is thinking this literally, obviously, is that they want that big fish to go out there and fuck and then, you know, make loads of big fishes.
Didn't have to put it like that.
I don't know. I'm just trying to think what big fish, there's got to be some way that analogy translates, and I can't find a way it works. But yeah, the point being, in this big pond is now another fish, just another fish, another quite nice, shiny fish. But is that tasty to all the other people collecting fish in that big pond? I don't know. I hate this analogy. It's really ruining me. It's really getting to my, it's really upsetting me now. So let's move on from that analogy. So it gets to this planet. It's very shiny. The Doctor's reintroduced. Slightly different haircut to suggest he's been there for a while. Although, to be honest, in this incarnation of the show, it could just mean anything. He just has a different haircut. I was just like, that's just something he can do now. I just take it. And he plays some fun stuff here, which reminded me a bit of like Stephen Moffat stuff, the whole thing of every ninth word being a word that the the cycle of the AI doesn't catch felt very Stephen
Moffat-y.
It's
the robots can't hear it, but what you said about AI is interesting because it's definitely speaking to the kind of how do we get around having all these AI kind of interactions forced onto us without our consent and like having to like just work around them. Like, how do I Google something now? Google minus AI. And like, it's interesting to be like for that to kind of have a, I don't know, like a linguistic kind of quality.
Yeah, absolutely. The AI, it is the machine code with the AI because he uses it at the end as well when he's talking to her. But yeah, this whole notion of trying to outmatch machines.
Yeah.
It's becoming harder. I thought it was a nice moment. I think one of the issues I had with the story was that I found it quite hard to actually follow the rationale, even when it's explained later. And especially, I suppose, because some of it isn't explained. So you've almost
I was just there for the ride. I wasn't really.
Yeah, so it explains this kind of loop with Al or AI and Belinda. But then there's another bit of this loop which isn't explained, which is how this certificate becomes two.
And I think
there's a bit that does make this, it does weaken the show as an episode as a vessel in itself, because the things which you're trying to work out earlier when it explains what's going on, it's having to admit some of the stuff which it's not going to explain yet. And yet the audience is still trying to work out if that is part of this explanation. And I think it can just derail a bit of that sort of flow for the audience who's left a little confused, trying to pull some strands together which haven't actually been, that aren't in the offering yet, and can take you a bit away from where's. I think that was probably my only issue with it. It just ended up being a little complicated.
Perhaps
than it needed to be. Yeah.
I mean, that is the show.
It is, but this was one of the few times I felt like that payoff wasn't quite as clear as I think as it needed to be. And I think part of that was because some of it still remains unclear. And I think that came a bit distracting from a story which I just don't think anyone really cared. I think in the end, you're there in the moment. I think Belinda's good. You've got some quite nice secondary characters which are introduced, which sort of work. You've got a good aesthetic, some fun things like the X-ray blankets, which is a lovely idea. And almost like the whole reason this is all occurs starts to become less and less interesting in a weird way. But yeah, I think what sold it to me mostly is Belinda all the way through was an enjoyable character without feeling...
Not like a strong character, just like a really strong performance.
That's
and
it.
Like a well-written,
yes.
Like interesting, three-dimensional, like believable person.
I think it's the believable thing which gets me, because often with some of these characters, like people like Rose, well, most of them, they'll end up doing stuff which doesn't feel like an average person would do. They'll turn and confront an enemy in a way which an average normal person wouldn't do, as because they're special in a way. And that leaves you feeling that this feels a bit contrived. While her reactions, Belinda's reactions, felt kind of what I could imagine people in her situation might do. They might actually take ownership of this whole situation. And at the end, when she's dealing with Al, that again felt honest, and it was self-sacrificial, it was heroic, but it didn't feel like it was trying, it didn't feel artificial in itself. It felt, yeah, I could see again why she could see this as the only outcome, because quite frankly, there aren't many other outcomes where it could go. So
yeah,
I like that.
It didn't feel self-defeating. It felt sort of like a calculated, sort of rational assessment, really. Like, there are very few options. This is an option that I'm choosing. It gives me slightly more autonomy, and it's still crap.
Yeah.
I think it was also interesting the way that she speaks to the doctor after that, which is that, you know, I'm not a toy I'm not like the latest in a long line of, you know, people you're actually quite dangerous and I want to leave. And I don't want to be swept up in this sort of current of charisma. I think it's better to, I'd rather go back.
And would you want that? I mean, this is what I found really annoying with Doctor Who for the last 20 years, is if you go on any of those adventures, they're horrible. People are dying. Nice people die all the time. You're constantly overpowered and you're really reliant on a superheroed character to keep you alive.
I think that, you know, the central conceit of Doctor Who is like the power of his personality overcoming everything. It overcomes the companions, all of the people he meets, you know, all the people that rely on him, you know, all the enemies. And I think it is really fascinating because, like, every decisions that the companions make, it's like a toss-up between how powerful is the Doctor's magnetism and this, you know, urge for adventure across space and time. But it's not really... It's never portrayed as... The companions are never portrayed as, like, explorer characters.
No.
Or as people who are fundamentally dedicated to the idea of, like, you know, exploration or gathering knowledge or doing specific things. But they're only like that in association with the Doctor character. And it always seems... And they get caught up in it. It's not necessarily that the Doctor allows them to do the thing that they've always wanted to do. Like, there are kind of flavours of that here and there, but it's almost always sort of generated by the Doctor, which kind of suggests that none of the companions can never last because they don't exist in the same space just as themselves. Like, if they had a choice, would they be wandering the galaxy by themselves for the, you know, pursuit of adventure and, you know, always being on the move? It doesn't seem like any of the companion characters would ever do that. So they are only able, they only become part of that journey through him. So everything is relying on him, which really is the, you know, that's the fundamentals of a coercive, controlling relationship, which is that everything comes down to this one person, which is, he has eventually not necessarily through force or threat, not or threat of violence, although that's not necessarily absent either, but it's through, like, persuasion and, you know, making other things not an option and, you know, well, I'd really prefer it if you did this, or this thing makes me so happy, and, oh, wouldn't you think that this is great, even though I know that you wanted the exact opposite, but, you know, I'm really charming and you really like me and I think this is a good idea. It's that kind of push persuasion all the time. So yeah, I think it was quite interesting.
As you say, and that even that last scene has that with him, and she sort of says, "You took my DNA without permission." You know, you are again that whole issue of control and power, which is, I think, more what this is about. As you say, more than sort of incel, it's about positions of power, positions of control, who has power. And I think what you're saying with the companions there, I find, especially in this most recent era, this 20-year era, it's often felt like they're not explorers, but it's the commentary is always that there's something, whether it's capitalism or class or something, which is keeping people in a position where if they were removed from that, those pressures, their potential becomes unlocked and they are more than what society will allow them to be, which would be fine to me, but it still feels like the person they becomes a person which has to find pleasure in situations where there is deep distress and discomfort. And I never feel like these people really grow into becoming people who would manage that sort of space. They sort of exist in this place where it's still exciting and fun as it is for an audience, and that's mapped onto that character, when really that character should be more like this here, where she's like, story writer, you're going to have to find a good reason to keep me here, because quite frankly, as a person, I wouldn't want to stay in this, because this is shit. I want to go home. I want to be safe. And so it's up to the story writer to find a reason to go, well, okay, that's fine, but oh wait, no, we can't do that yet.
And also not turn the Doctor into an overt monster in the process. Yeah. Because I think also it's interesting when she talks about the DNA swap, which is that he obviously never considered at all that would be something that he would need permission or consent for. And it's interesting because you have this character who's basically just not all powerful, but he's pretty close. Especially in comparison to, you know, an everyday person, like that, he doesn't stop to consider these things, because he doesn't really have anyone, you know, performing any checks and balances.
Mm.
It's like, just because you can do that doesn't mean that you should do that. And which isn't to say that he's like a bad person or a bad character. But there are so many, you know, tiny violations that happen constantly that he obviously never thinks about. So he doesn't have to, and he's kind of thinking on like a macro scale rather than a micro scale. So yeah.
But when that, I mean, even in all our, any job that we have where there are rules, we know a lot of the rules are there, as you say, to bind us and to manage and to hopefully create a fair, reasonable and understanding society. But if they weren't there and you had your job to do and you knew there was no one's going to check you on it, you would occasionally, at very least occasionally, just ignore them because you don't have to respond to them. So I think, as you say, I think that's quite interesting with him, is that he is a person who doesn't have to. So doesn't, especially when he knows what he's doing in that particular time, in that particular moment, in his mind, is not unethically, it's not problematic, even though he doesn't really consider for her, it's a sign of something which is, especially someone who lives in a world where that is very much something they have to consider.
Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's quite a nuanced little bit of writing. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Because also, like, he could have said the same lines, had the same, almost the same conversation with her, and just been like, I have met your descendant, like, you know, in the year 50,000, whatever. At least I'm pretty sure she's your descendant, because she looks exactly fucking like you. Look at this. Look at it. Look at it. And then, like, can I swap your DNA? I bet you'd be like an 1,000,000% match. Like, there was not really any, there wasn't that much of a reason to just take her DNA, other than just curiosity and wanting to be like, wanting to check and being excited and curious. But the fact that he never considers that that might be a problem is interesting.
I mean, there is a darker reading to it, that he is a person with good intentions, but is coercive and does play with power. And by doing that, he, perhaps you could read him as someone who knows that that usually wows someone, that makes them suddenly feel like he's worth listening to, because not only does he have all this new information, he has evidence and he can just take evidence like that. You know, there's a sort of a sense of, if I was in that position and you're trying to get someone in the place where you want them to be, is that what he's doing? And again, it's up to how you read it, but that to me is probably quite an accurate reading of the character. Certainly certain incarnations of the characters or certain stories would suggest that that wouldn't be an unreasonable reading.
It's interesting, because I think this incarnation of the character is almost like a masterclass in what it would take to become a cult leader. It's like, you meet this person, they rescue you from this terrible situation that you probably couldn't get out by yourself, and suddenly they, you know, They gain your trust. They help you. They rescue you. Things are made right. And then you're whisked away in this sort of magical time traveling box, which is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And it's like, oh, wow, this is amazing. And, you know, showing you all these cool things. And it's just this whirlwind of like personality and charisma. And it's just like, it's basically, it's almost like love bombing, where, you know, one person like is suddenly dumps all of this affection and attention and, oh, you're so special. Oh, I really need you. And you're amazing, onto another person. And it just overwhelms like sort of more rational part of the brain, and you become like very, very intensely attached to somebody that you actually don't really know that well, and that becomes, you know, a way of controlling people. So yeah, I think there's a lot of, yeah, and I think Inshuti sort of carries that off really, really well, because he is charismatic and he is, you know, he's a stunning looking person. And especially the way that his wardrobe has been organized this season, it generates a very specific thing. Yeah, it makes him like an object of, you know, intrigue and fascination and desire. So all of that is kind of bound up in this kind of, I think a lot of the incarnations have had like a manic energy to them. Like David Tennant definitely has that kind of, sort of like, oh, and then and this and this, and there is still charisma in the other incarnations, but I think this in particular, you can see that there is like a shadow side to it, because like when they have that conversation from like, actually you're a bit dangerous and I'm really sure about this and I want to go home, and you said you take me home, so take me home, because yeah, okay. And then they have trouble with the TARDIS. And there is that part of my mind which is like, that's a red flag. That's a red flag. Oh, suddenly you have a flat tire and you can't go anywhere. Oh, no.
Well, it'd be interesting to see in the next episode whether they play into any of that, because that would be a very natural reaction for her, which was kind of almost there at that point, a sort of slight suspicion. Yeah. And I think, as you say, I mean, like with David Tennant, there was, I suppose it's all down to the eye of the beholder, but there's a sort of geeky gawkiness about him, even at the best of the time. But Inshuti Gatwa is just pretty much a perfect aesthetic for human being in these absolutely perfect clothes, multiple clothes as well. You know, the sort of person, like, I remember watching Brad Pitt in Fight Club and thinking, yeah, this is a guy who can just wear absolutely anything or have any haircut and will just always look fantastic. You know, he has got that sort of level of, you know, yeah, and that is in a weird way even more scary, because the vulnerabilities there are not as present in a funny way, even though the character is obviously shows vulnerabilities.
I think that's interesting as well, because obviously in this episode, when his friend is killed, he cries, or he sheds a few tears, which is, I guess, still quite unusual for that character. I mean, I know that Tennant did it sort of a little bit, but Inshuti's version is definitely, you know, being portrayed as being much more in tune with his emotions and much more like open.
Yes.
So then perhaps a bit more emotionally honest. And at the same time, it's giving me this sense of like emotional manipulation, basically. Which it's just what I'm reading into it, which is like, oh, it's interesting that, you know, this doctor is able to cry. That's a good thing. You know, we want men to be able to cry and access and deal with their emotions. That's a good thing. That's something that, you know, most of society is like kind of recognizing as, if we tell a certain set of people that they can't cry and be sad, turns out that's actually a bad thing. And then bad stuff happens because they've repressed all their feelings. And so it's interesting that, you know, as each incarnation is like sort of a little bit like the new and improved Doctor 2.0. But this new and improved version, like, although he's in tune with his feelings and he feels them and he expresses them, doesn't last for very long. Like, it's quite short and he's able to like move past it quite quickly, which either suggests that these feelings are transient, so perhaps they're not that deep, or that it's a tactic for some reason, that it's a, you know, a performative thing, which is also kind of speaking to this theme of like manipulation and sort of coercive control, or the potential for it, because, you know, these things aren't necessarily only about that, but they are behaviors that are utilized by people to get that outcome, which is sort of control over things. And Doctor Who is like, you know, an exemplary, he basically has control over the whole universe. He has control over time and space. So effectively, for an everyday person, the Doctor is the ultimate authority in the universe.
Yeah, there is I very much see that. There was a bit in the beginning where he uses that sonic screwdriver on the computer to get the information and shuts down the entire
whole hospital.
Did you have the same sort of like, oh my God?
We have just walked past the intensive care unit.
Yes.
If there's a place in the hospital where you do not want to lose all the power, it's the place in the hospital when all the patients are critically ill and reliant on machines to be alive. I know in reality, all of those things are going to be backed up by generators, but at the same time, have a little care.
I mean, I know this is obviously...
And, you know, that speaks again to this, like, the nurse at the workstation saying, sorry, I can't give out.
Yes.
I cannot give out an employee's home address, you absolute maniac. And he's like, look over there. Ha-ha, I've stolen it. Which is all funny, ha-ha. But in reality, huge violation of personal privacy.
Yeah.
It's necessary for the progression of the story, of course, and we're on his side. We know that he doesn't mean to turn off the entire hospital. But at the same time, those things can be read in like through another lens.
But this is it. And this is what we do. We're overreading this, which is fun. Because, I mean, you think about that moment. If we've got someone who has a brain which can see transcendentally, it must have known that there was a possibility that his screwdriver would actually short out the entire hospital. But, and he knew that there would be other ways he could get that address or find where she lives. It might have taken a bit longer, but in that moment, he decided that was the way he was going to do it because that was the way he wanted to do it.
Because he was impatient.
Because he was impatient. A Time Lord who's got all the time that he wants at his hands is impatient. Which then you could sort of argue, well, this is a sort of a systemic Doctor problem, is that he just doesn't, this is how his world works. This is how he's always processed and the way that he lives in his world and how he sees it is because he's doing the same sort of thing all the time. It's, you know, okay, that tenant, the whole idea of the tenant split with him, the bioregeneration was that he was someone who was now kind of, as you said, cured of all that sort of gothy emo upset. That's what he sort of suggests. He sort of says, yeah. I'm you, but I've got over through the timey-wimeyness. I've got over all the issues you've got, so I'm fresh and new to go. But he's living the same.
If I had therapy and if I was a little younger.
Yes. But I mean, his life is the same. So invariably, that stuff's going to just start cropping up again.
But it does suggest that he's simply not an experiential learner. Which I guess you do need the character to be somewhat, you know, static in a way, because it's the Doctor and he kind of needs to remain, you know, essentially the same in order for it to, the whole conceit to work. It's like what you were saying about it being mythological, like Robin Hood. Robin Hood needs to kind of remain largely the same in order to exist and make the whole story work.
Well, I mean, there's an argument that gods, in theory, you know, gods wouldn't change. Gods would probably be the most by their definition being sort of ahistoric, they would pretty much probably carry a similar sort of way to exist, because that would be how they exist. They wouldn't be, I mean, narratively, yeah, they would say they're changed, but anything that lasts over eternity surely gets over the point where change is meaningless. And maybe that's where this character is. And I know this is all sort of narrative jumps, but I think they're interesting jumps to make. Sorry, sort of character jumps. Like, why is he doing? What is he? And again, as I say, the whole issue of control and coercion is so much part of this character. And in certain incarnations, as people listening to this podcast will know, like Sylvester McCoy's incarnation was very much played on that this was a person who was now to a point where he was just playing games with life, that he was one step ahead of everyone else, and the means justified the end. And that's a sort of darker version of the character. Not that dark. Well, in the books he got very dark, but in the show he never got quite that dark. But there's this suggestion that when you pretty much know everything and you can go everywhere and you decide to become a champion of time, suddenly the smaller people become like chess pieces.
I mean, champion of time.
There was an era where it's an argument that he becomes time's champion, that there's a sort of symbolic...
But making sure the right timeline...
Kind of, happens. Yeah. Sort of almost the Time Lord Victoria sort of notion that you have the power, if you have the power to make things right. And if that means that you have to play a few games because you're at that level where everything does become more of a game, which invariably it must when you have got so many more... When you're basically playing on God mode the whole time. And we've all played video games where if you're on God mode, you know, sometimes it is easier for the smaller people to be crushed underfoot. People have played SimCity. You know, I remember when I was a kid playing SimCity and you got God mode and you were quite happily putting Godzillas and whirlwinds and hurricanes and seeing what happened. It's what people do. And yeah, when you get to that sort of level of power, it goes back to what you were saying earlier. Where are the checks and balances? Who manages you and prevents you from taking those steps? Which the show has talked about before, but I don't think it's talked about in such a personalized way as from the perspective of a companion actually challenging it and going, yeah, you are actually exhibiting controlling elements.
Megalomania.
Not too far, well, some distance, but along the same tracks as Al. You know, you are controlling. You are coercing me to stay and do these things. I've told you I don't want to, and yeah, I can still see your eyes. You want to have your way. So I think it's a really interesting episode for all these little things that are bubbling under the surface. Do you feel engaged in watching the next one? As someone, as we've said before, who is not a patron of this podcast or reads or consumes this material.
Well, I really like Belinda.
Mm.
I really like Belinda. I think she's interesting. So I think I will watch the next one.
Good.
I'm not happy with the vibe of weird cartoon TV villain.
Oh, what, at the beginning?
Really Anita, not my scene.
Yes, the fourth wall breaking bit as well. Is that what you're talking about?
I was not talking about that. I mean the preview for the next episode.
Oh, the preview. Yeah, I didn't actually watch the preview, although I think I know what's coming up from a trailer I saw.
But speaking of the woman at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
What's all that about? Is the deep lore mythos being winked at?
No one knows. Obviously, all the fans, as usual, hark back to a female Time Lord called the Rani, who they are convinced this time it's the Rani. They've been saying this for virtually every season of Doctor Who where a female antagonist comes in, that it's got to be this character, and it never has been. Who can say? But apparently this season we find out, so all bets are off. But yeah, the fourth wall breaking is, again, a kind of a contentious tactic. It didn't bother me. It's a show, isn't it?
I think in part it's that older... with him are basically invisible on TV. So you really need to make sure the audience is paying attention to the character in order for them to follow the through line. So in order to do that, you literally need to sit the audience down and be like, look, this lady is important. Remember this for later. And now back to the show.
And to be honest, I think she's obviously a very powerful character by the looks of it. Like the Doctor, on your a level of gods, who knows what fourth walls you break, or fifth walls, or sixth walls. You know, can you see the viewer? Quite possibly.
It also, that checks and balances thing does make me wonder whether the companions are meant to be fulfilling the role of checks and balances.
Like, yeah, that
perhaps, is this why he seeks out companions, not just because he's, you know, really fundamentally lonely, but perhaps knows that he can't be trusted to function alone.
Yeah.
He will wander away from what might be, you know, he might have the best intentions, but materially might do bad things. Well, really bad things.
I think Donna said that once, and I think Bill said it as well. There is this notion, yeah, if he travels by himself, that it's dangerous, that they are, as you say, is checks and balances. But again, if that's the case, and that's not ever properly recognised, and it feels very not unnatural, but if that dynamic's not understood, and you are needing these people to facilitate or control yourself, I don't know. That's not a great space either. If they're not aware that that's what they're doing.
I think it'd be interesting to go back to it being like a grandfather and a granddaughter.
Yes, I do. The one thing I like about this is that I think the sort of strapline for this series is kind of like take her home. So I'm getting the assumption that in each episode is a slow trek back home. And I like the idea that we're not doing this, as you were saying before, this these companions.
Dewy-eyed.
Yes.
Naive.
Yes.
Explorer.
It's just someone who just wants to go home, which is very much like, as you were alluding to, the two teachers and the grandchild. It wasn't a massive adventure. It was a way to get home, get them home. And there was lots of difficulties and dangers on the way. And to me, I think that's a more authentic way to look at it, and I've said this many times before, but they both, the Doctor and the companion, just look a bit sociopathic if they just see this as a glorified adventure where they go from one. It's pretty creepy. So cool. So you enjoyed it, you would watch it next week if you get time. The Christmas special episode, I still think you'd quite like that. I know you haven't seen that. I think the show's in a good space. It's just, again, it's whether it's a space where it can get the platform it needs to be viable.
I think in a lot of ways, that's not actually up to the show.
No.
Really?
Well, that's it. Exactly. That's what I mean. I don't think it's down. I don't think the problem is the content. It's the problem of shows like this, which require a lot of money, tap into certain audiences in a pool of lots of other shows which are getting a lot of money, high quality, adjacent either in genre or drama or in...
But also, those other shows, like, that can't continue forever. The bubble will have to burst.
Mm. Yeah.
So those other shows are also facing the same problems.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's it. And most of them don't go more than 3-4 seasons. Oh, this is a show which has gone 20. So it's in a difficult position. But I think if it does go out, I think it's going out on a strong point if the rest of the season's like this. Brilliant. Okay, well, I think we'll leave it there. That's been a long ramble through this show. I hope anyone listening to this has found it mildly entertaining, at worst, at best, maybe slightly informative with some interesting ideas or concepts they've not thought about before, but I will go with just the former, and you will catch this podcast in some form or another next time.